Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, June 13th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. This week, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible by visiting www.patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging your support. Specifically, I want to give a shout out to Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Hubble's Minion Space Blog, Charles Payet, Jafe, The Honorable Husband, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so much. It's because of support from listeners like you that we can keep Talk Nerdy 100% free to download. All right, guys, I'm not quite sure how to preface this week's episode. Obviously, most everybody listening, regardless of whether or not you're in the States, are aware of the horrific mass shooting that took place in Orlando over the weekend at a gay nightclub. It has been sort of claimed at this point by the Islamic State. And I think in many ways, this episode is quite prescient in light of that tragedy. So I do want to preface letting you guys know that we did record this episode, obviously, previous to this happenstance. I think it's an important one. I think the conversations that we have are necessary, but they may be a little bit difficult. So if you are still reeling from just this horrible atrocity, you may want to wait just a little while to listen in. That said, I am very excited to welcome this week's podcast guest. His name is Phil Torres. I know I have podcasted with a Phil Torres previously. That was Phil Torres, the entomologist. But this is Phil Torres, the author, the affiliate scholar at the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, and the founder of the X-Risks Institute for the Study of Extremism, which you can look up by visiting www.risksandreligion.org. He's also the author of a new book, The End, What Science and Religion Tell Us About the Apocalypse. So without any further ado, here he is, Phil Torres. Phil, I am so excited to be talking to you today, especially after bumping into you at the Reason Rally.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah. So we were doing a panel. Actually, my last episode was with Chris Johnson, who wrote A Better Life and did the documentary A Better Life. And we were doing a panel about the doc. And you came to that panel and said hi after. And of course, you and I had been corresponding via email prior to that because you were recommended by some mutual friends because you wrote a great new book.
Yeah, the panel was fantastic. The room was totally packed. But some of the conversations that went on were extremely insightful, and it was a pleasure meeting you at Reason Rally of all places.
Oh yay. And so you are hailing from, because we're obviously recording remotely, I am in LA and you are in one of the Carolinas, if I remember correctly.
Yes, the North Carolina.
The north of the Carolinas.
Yeah.
Are you in Research Triangle? Where do you live?
So my wife is a professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
Nice.
So we live right down the road in this actually co-housing community with lots. It's kind of built on socialistic principles. So there's a lot of public land. It's a really extraordinary place with gardens and herbs all over the place.
No way. You live in like a university commune?
Yeah. So it's not officially affiliated with the university. But it is right down the road. It's one of several in this area.
That's fascinating.
It's a marvelous place. Some really, really awesome people. A lot of professors live there. And like I said, there are gardens everywhere. There's a big common house, a guest house. It's wonderful.
Interesting. But like, it's still America, right? Like, it's not like a commune in the sense that you're kind of making your own laws.
That's true. We're not a little independent nation state you know, within the United States.
That's good. So I want to know about your background, because I want to know what prompted you. Before we dive into the book, which I have in my hands right now, it's called The End, What Science and Religion Tells Us About the Apocalypse, which is like so fun. But before we dive into that, I want to know about, you know, where, not just where you came from, but why this topic was sparked in your mind. Like, tell me a little bit about your kind of academic and sort of, I don't know, your background in terms of your interests.
Sure. So my educational background is mostly in philosophy, but I've also, I mean, I earned a master's in neuroscience from Brandeis University. And in part, the there was sort of this, you know, the master's was part of a foray into a field of scientific inquiry that I didn't at the time know all that much about. But I was really interested in the, you know, the wetware of the mind, mostly because I was really fascinated by philosophy of mind kind of stuff. So beyond that, though, and perhaps more germane to the book itself, I grew up in a Christian household that accepted a particular interpretation of Christian scripture called dispensationalism.
What? What is that?
So dispensationalism is, you know about it, although not by that term. So basically, whenever you hear about the rapture, you're talking about, or the context is dispensationalism. So this is a very interesting, very I would say very clever interpretation of scripture that really emerged in the 1800s it was sort of invented by this guy named John Nelson Darby, who was an Irish preacher.
Okay.
And Irish Anglo preacher. And so he had this, you know, for the longest time, a lot of the biggest Christian theologians held to a view called amillennialism, which is this notion that the thousand-year millennium was a figurative millennium, and it was sort of happening in parallel with the unfolding of world history. And he came along and said, no, what's going to happen is there's going to be, the church is going to be raptured from earth. So all the living Christians will be taken up into heaven by Jesus. And then there will be the seven-year period of called the tribulation, of, you know, horrific suffering and so on. And after that, Jesus will return. That's the second coming. There will be the Battle of Armageddon. And then a literal 1,000-year millennial kingdom will commence at that point.
And so none of this has happened yet.
So none of this has happened. There's a huge percentage of Christians in the U.S. who are eagerly awaiting this you know, momentous event in cosmic history. And there, in fact, some are, you know, have a more activist orientation to these issues, and are in some way trying to catalyze events that would introduce, you know, the rapture and then the tribulation and so on. Because if you don't have the tribulation, then, you know, you don't, world peace will forever elude us.
So that's basically a heady way to say that there are actual dispensationalists out there who are trying to hurry the apocalypse up.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah,
Jesus Christ.
Right. So there are some, this is one thing I talk about in the book as it happens. And I'll mention why in just a moment. But yeah, there's definitely a significant number of Christians who genuinely believe that the rapture is imminent. I mean, there was a poll from 2010 that found 47%, something very close to that, of Americans, not just Christians, but Americans, believe that Jesus will return either probably or definitely by 2050. And I would say a large percentage of those individuals do hold the dispensationalist view that, the rapture is going to occur and, you know, they'll be taken back into heaven for 7 years.
So dispensationalism exists within a lot of kind of core evangelical Protestant faiths. Like, you see it existing in certain types of, like, Southern Baptist or, you know, different, especially these revival-type religions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, as it happens, some of the leading candidates for president from the Republican Party Almost certainly hold dispensationalist views. So Ted Cruz might be a good example. In fact, his father has been quoted. His father is part of a very related sect of Christian thought called Dominionism. Mm-hmm. Excuse me. And you know, and this holds that you know the Christians have a divine calling to take over all of the different domains of have dominion over these domains. Of you know contemporary culture,
yeah.
So along those lines, he you know believes that there's this end times transfer of wealth, and that Ted Cruz is instrumental in this process. So there really is a lot of I think a lot of people who aren't immersed in this in the world mm-hmm. of sort of you know evangelical fundamentalist Christianity are surprised to hear. How ubiquitous these beliefs are, but they really genuinely are held by a huge number of people. I mean, they've been, you know, there are scholars out there who have argued you really can't understand U.S. foreign policy for the last, you know, seven decades mm-hmm. unless you understand dispensational. You understand that the, you know, a Jewish state in Palestine is absolutely necessary for the tribulation to commence. So there's this very strong eschatological motivation for people to defend you do whatever it takes to defend Israel against its many, genuine enemies in the area.
Yeah, but, that's this unholy yeah. kind of relationship that we see here between sort of what we think of as traditionally Jewish lefties and these hardcore right-wing evangelical Christians yeah. have this sort of intense pro-Israel pact between them that I think to the outside world doesn't really make a lot of sense unless you actually dig deep into the theology. But you know what? When I talk to people about that, I always question it. I ask about it because it seems strange and interesting to me. But I notice that many of the people I have on the podcast who are really liberal progressive thinkers and I think who pride themselves in understanding some aspect of like geopolitical conflict and you know, some of the motivations behind the decision-making that a lot of world leaders engage in, I still feel mm-hmm. like they minimize this exact point, this dispensationalist point, that like there's a legitimate core community of individuals who actually think that Jesus is coming back, who actually think that the rapture is going to occur, and they need this holy land, this promised land, in order to be able to ensure that this happens the way that it was meant to happen. I think yeah. a lot of people roll their eyes and go, yeah, but they don't actually think that. Like maybe there's like a handful of them, but most people are just duped by that. But what you're saying is a lot of people actually believe that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a huge mistake to ignore that the, you know, this sort of eschatological component.
I'm loving that word. You've used it twice. You have to tell me what it means.
Yeah, so eschatology is just the study of the end of the world.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, so eschatology is, you know, it really was invented by the ancient Persians, uh-huh. you know, probably 2,000 years before Christ. You've probably heard of the religion of Zoroastrianism.
Yeah.
And so Zoroaster was a prophet who received all these revelations, and as a result of that, he sketched out this, you know, this chronology of, a kind of rough chronology of events that would happen. And this series of events involve a virgin-born savior mm-hmm. who you know appears to usher in the basically an Armageddon-like battle between you know it's a cosmic struggle between good and evil, and that would be followed by a bodily resurrection of all of the believers.
Yeah,
And then a great judgment, a final judgment on humanity, and you know half of you know the believers would end up in paradise, and the disbelievers in perdition. So it's kind of, I mean, really, there's a sense in which not only Zoroaster, arguably the most influential individual in world history, more than Marx or Jesus or Muhammad, because you know it's his view has been borrowed by Judaism and then by Christianity and Islam and so on. There are all these extraordinary parallelisms and isomorphisms between the narratives, but yeah, I mean Zoroaster sort of introduced this linear notion of time with a beginning and then consequently an end as well.
Do we know when Zoroaster was first proclaiming these things? Was this parable? Was this allegory? Was it like a Nostradamus kind of, I foresee in the future, this is what's going to happen legitimately? Or was this sort of a warning for, you know, social control and to help kind of dispel or calm some political unrest? Do we have good historical records as to like the motivation and whether or not this truly was a thought that was actually believed versus some sort of parable?
Yeah, it's a great question. I don't think we know at this point. I mean, it is the records are not very robust going that far back.
Sure.
But yeah, we do know the basics of his you know the religious ideology that he constructed, and also the eschatological sort of narrative that attended that ideology. So yeah, it's kind of, so I guess part of the reason I mentioned that is to say that the influence of end times thinking throughout the world, I mean, not just in the West but also in the East. Although I know the West much, much better, it's really been significant. It's been sort of hidden. In fact, if you read scholars who write about this sort of thing, almost invariably in the first chapter, in the first couple paragraphs, they'll say, what a shame it is that historians have not spent more time thinking about the influence of these sorts of, you know, future looking beliefs on, you know, world events. I mean, Nazism was founded on an eschatological notion. You know, it's not a coincidence that Hitler talked about the thousand-year Reich.
Yeah.
Marxism is the exact same. There's extraordinary similarities between his, you know, you start out with primitive communism, you end up with pure communism, you know, paradise. And in between, there's sort of, you know, the fall, which is the introduction of property and alienation and things of that sort.
And of course, we see it now with ISIS and with this new caliphate. And I think we see it with this sort of American, especially on the religious right, this like inability to process or to admit that climate change is something that we actually need to be focusing on.
Yeah. Yeah. So with respect to the Islamic State, without a doubt, I mean, if you read the scholarly literature on this, you'll discover quite quickly that both Sunnis and Shiites interpreted the U.S. invasion as a clear, unequivocal fulfillment of prophetic, various prophetic hadith. You know, for example, there's talk of the Byzantines that would invade Muslim lands multiple times. It's something emphasized by the Shiites. The Sunni, you know, the Islamic State, initially they were founded by a radical psychopathic apocalypticist named al-Zarqawi, and he saw signs of the end times everywhere. He's actually quoted in the beginning of the Islamic State's online propaganda magazine saying something very, very close to, you know, the spark has been lit here in Iraq and will burn by Allah's permission until the armies reach the town of Dabiq. And Dabiq is a small Syrian, very small Syrian town right by Aleppo. People might be more familiar with Aleppo. And that is where the Islamic Armageddon is supposed to happen. So that's part of the reason why so many beheadings, so many atrocities have taken place in Dabiq.
Yeah.
Jihadi John, one of the videos was filmed there, and he says, here we are burying the first crusader, eagerly awaiting the arrival of the rest of your armies. I think that was James Foley. His severed head, I mean, it's very gruesome scene, but his severed head was Jihadi John's feet at the time. So yeah, I mean, I think it's really a mistake to, you know, to ignore or to think that the influence of eschatological thinking is not profound.
Yeah, why do we have this fear almost, or this repulsion of trying to empathize, of trying to understand the motivations of these largely organized groups, and instead just discount their motivations as being crazy or religiously motivated, or, oh, it's not religious, it's geopolitical, and it's unfair to call it religious, or for whatever reason, looking at these things in a more passive and kind of minimizing the true motivations behind them? Why do we do that so often?
That's a good question. I mean, that's, I suppose, a question for a psychologist or maybe sociologist. It's perhaps, I mean, my, maybe just a conjecture would be that it's easier to, you know, there's something attractive about a simplistic explanation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, simpler explanations often end up being right. But we shouldn't misinterpret what Occam's razor actually says. It says if you have multiple hypotheses that equally are equally adequate in terms of explaining a given phenomenon, then you should pick the simpler one.
Yeah.
So it's not that simpler explanations as such are better. So, I mean, my own view, and I think this is the view that is really you'll find in the scholarly literature about terrorism, is that it is a combination of factors, one, ideological, and two, material.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, I'd mentioned that you know, people all throughout the Middle East saw the 2003 preemptive invasion led by the U.S. as a fulfillment of prophecy.
Yeah.
So I mean, if that material event had not occurred, then because before that, I should say, I mean, the Sunni population really wasn't that interested in apocalyptic thinking. Like, it just wasn't that popular at the time until the 2003 invasion. And then suddenly you have this extraordinary burgeoning of apocalyptic thinking, you know, as I mentioned, throughout the region.
Sure. So, I mean, imagine that we're all here hanging out in the States. The vast majority of individuals might think this in the back of their head. Some of them might take it more seriously. But when we have some sort of like horrific, I don't know, weather event or something, and it starts raining locusts, people might start to think a little bit differently.
Yeah,
and it'll be in the forefront of their minds.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's, I feel like it becomes intuitive if you reverse, you know, if Iran had preemptively invaded the U.S., I guarantee there'd be a huge portion, a huge demographic that would interpret that as, you know, this is the inauguration of Armageddon.
Yeah.
Completely.
And I also wonder a little bit if there is something about human psychology, because I think you see this a lot with individuals who argue about, quote unquote, supporting the troops, and how do you support the troops, and are you patriotic? Are you not patriotic? There's this almost fear to try to explore and understand human motivation, because the minute that you start to speak from the viewpoint of the individual, however much you don't condone what they're doing,
mm-hmm.
It almost seems to the outside world like you're kind of condoning it.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this weird idea that if I want to fully understand my enemy, or I want to fully understand an organized group that I think could do harm, and I either infiltrate or I really do a lot of scholarly study, that just understanding them and knowing them somehow makes me one of them.
Yeah, I think that's a problematic line of reasoning. In fact, right here at University of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
There was, I believe this was two semesters ago, So last year,
mm-hmm.
there was a professor in the English department teaching a class on, I believe it was the apocalyptic literature, or maybe just more generally, just the literature surrounding Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
And you may have heard about this, because there was a student, I believe for the group Campus Reform, who wrote a blog post condemning this, saying that this is abhorrent because it's sympathizing with the terrorists. And that made the front page of Fox News. It was widely talked about. The guy got all sorts of hate mail. It was really, you know, ended up being quite a snafu as a result.
Yeah.
But really what he's doing is trying to, you know, I mean, other scholars of terrorism have mentioned this. You know, there's a gestalt switch that happens. And you have to allow yourself just momentarily to relinquish all of the values and the ethical values and the moral scruples that you have as a, you know, a citizen of the secular West,
mm-hmm.
and try to see the world through this particular framework. And only when you do that successfully can you really understand what the motivation is. And once you understand the motivation, of course, you can perhaps implement policies or design policies that effectively combat the actions of these groups, like the Islamic State.
And it's not easy, because first you have to get through the hurdle of the stigma involved just in trying to empathize. Then you actually have to successfully empathize, which is very difficult when you've potentially never had boots on the ground, or even if you have had your boots on the ground, you've never lived in the kind of poverty, or you've never been brought up in the kind of religious oppression, or, you know, there's so many different things that prevent us from being able to see the world through somebody else's eyes. And to have this stigma on top of it, that if you somehow attempt to do that, you are condoning the behavior, is just so counterproductive.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's a tough situation. You're right. I mean, it's doubly hard.
Yeah. Ugh.
You know, and it's unfortunate there's the other, you know, there, I mean, one of those barriers is unavoidable. The other one is not. You know, it's just a cultural like you said, it's a stigma. I mean, it's, you know, so
I want to kind of, I was like going down a rabbit hole with that, but it was fascinating to me. I could talk about that the whole show, but you were talking about being raised in this dispensationalist, religion. What denomination was it?
So we kind of floated around, but mostly it was Baptist.
Mm-hmm.
But the notion that the rapture is imminent was always kind of a background to my childhood. I remember hearing that, you know, that Bill Clinton, I have vivid memories of watching him get elected on, you know, election night, and having it just sort of ringing in my head that Bill Clinton is the Antichrist.
Oh my God.
You know, and that, you know, so this is the end. In fact, there was a survey not that long ago, a couple years ago, that found, if I remember correctly, 13% of Americans believe that Obama is the Antichrist.
Oh no!
So these beliefs are not. I mean, there is good news in with respect to the U.S. You know, the nuns, the religiously unaffiliated demographic is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only religion-related sort of demographic that, as far as I remember, that's increasing.
Yeah, the nones, not the nuns.
That's correct. Yes. Thank you for disambiguating that. Yeah, that's helpful. So globally, it's the exact opposite. Actually, the religiously unaffiliated people are shrinking from, I think, 16% to 13% by 2050. I guess I feel like as a kid, I always had, you know, I was inculcated with these ideas about the imminence of Armageddon and so on. So always kind of fascinated by the end of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then amazingly, you know, I ended up in college and started doing some research around in the early 2000s. Some sort of unknown scholars at the time, like Nick Bostrom, who's now at Oxford University and runs the Future of Humanity Institute, started talking about the basically eschatology, but in a way that's scientifically rigorous. And, you know, it discussed, so 1945, just to give a bit of history, 1945 was the start of the atomic age, was really it was the introduction of the first anthropogenic existential risk, right? So it was the first time that humanity could have self-annihilated itself.
Yeah.
You know, through, you know, the, after, you know, because of weaponizing the atom.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we sort of lived in the shadow of nuclear holocaust through the Cold War all the way up to the 90s. And then, you know, 2000s, we started to get some really advanced biotechnology. The last 10 years, we've seen the emergence of synthetic life, synthetic biology, and so on. And then there are a bunch of futurists who are talking about the promises and perils of future technologies like nanotechnology. Artificial intelligence has been in the news a lot recently. So there's sort of this swarm of brand new emerging global risks that have sort of kind of similar implications, at least in some sense, to some of the religious narratives that I grew up with.
Gotcha.
Except the epistemological basis of these new scenarios is radically different. It's not based on faith and revelation and, you know, hearsay, textual authority and so on, but it's based on evidence. It's based on experimentation, investigation of the physical world,
mm-hmm.
and then you know, logical inference, logical extrapolation from those observations. So it sort of had, you know, I feel like for the longest time, humans, you know, all the way since Zoroaster, humans have expected the end of the world at some point. And there are so many cases, many more cases than most people would suspect, of individuals saying that our generation is the last. And then suddenly 1945 comes around, and the possibility of a secular apocalypse peaks over the horizon of possibility.
Oof. And I have this image in my head of Dr. Strangelove, you know, during the Cold War and sitting in the war room with the big board and this juxtaposition of like these legitimate leaders having legitimate fears because there is a bomb on target into Russian territory. And then I can't remember the name of the character who's actually called on the strike, who's back in his office talking about the fucking fluoride conspiracy. And it's the same outcome, right? Yeah. But one is totally motivated by woo and myth, and the other is motivated by legitimate risk that they can calculate.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's there's a great, you know, potentially tragic irony with all of this. But also, I mean, I would emphasize that we're in a qualitatively different epoch than ever before. You know, self-annihilation is a genuine possibility. And really, if you read, you know, Nick Bostrom or Richard Posner, he's a famous University of Chicago legal scholar who wrote an extraordinary book on global catastrophes. And various others, Sir Martin Rees is one. John Leslie, I would say, founded the field of existential risk studies in 1996 when he published The End of the World. Which is, you know, this extraordinary, comprehensive, really sophisticated survey of all of the different ways that humanity could trip into the eternal grave of extinction. And, you know, but suddenly you really have some legitimate fears about, you know, some sort of global catastrophe. And if you read a lot of these individuals, you'll find that they believe that the world is not getting safer. It's getting much more dangerous. The probability of human extinction or some sort of global, you know, a collapse of, you know, human civilization today is higher than it's ever been in the 200,000 years that Homo sapiens has been around.
And is that just because of the insane kind of Moore's Law improvement in weaponized technology? You know, we look back at times when like all we had was a stick, and then it became an arrowhead, and then it became a single shooter gun, and then a six shooter, and then a semi-automatic, and, you know, all the way up to the nuclear bomb. Or is it also because of these other threats like, you know, poverty and climate change and geopolitical instability and all of these other things mixed together?
Yeah, so I don't think it's so much the latter.
Okay.
Although those could certainly be, they could be catastrophic. Mm-hmm. I mean, in unprecedented ways. You know, there's supposed to be 9.3 billion people by 2050. Slums are growing.
Yeah, it's like diseases that we kind of thought we had in check are like re-rearing their heads. We've got huge problems with antibiotic resistance.
Yeah.
You know, things that just happen because there's too many fucking people.
Yeah. So I remember you posting about the antibiotic resistant bacteria just the other day, because it's been in the news. I mean, it's quite, I think you said something like, it's time to be scared, folks. So I don't think that's wrong, but I think the main fear is with respect to, really the notion of an existential risk is a very temporally big picture idea. You know, there could be billions, trillions of humans or post-humans that have colonized the galaxy, and so on. If you sort of look further than just a couple generations, you know, it's not unreasonable to think that a lot is at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the issues that you just talked about, like poverty or, you know, some epidemic, these things are ultimately in as horrific as they are in an absolute sense, and they unambiguously are that. Mm-hmm. They're blips in sort of the, you know, the bigger picture of, you know, what could be humanity's biography.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the fears have to do with these emerging technologies that are dually usable. So, you know, the same technology can be used for nefarious ends, just as it could be used for benevolent ends. You know, so the same test tubes in which you grow certain, you know, you use to experiment to cure a disease. You could also use to create some sort of weaponized version of Ebola.
Yeah, and the same drones that could deliver medicine can also drop bombs.
Exactly. Same with centrifuges. You know, that's the big issue with, like, the Iran nuclear deal.
Mm-hmm. Same with energy. You know, we talk a lot about being able to use nuclear energy, but it can also be used to, you know, you've got these places where we have to try globally to police certain nations from being able to keep nukes, but at the same time, we can't prevent them from being able to keep the lights on.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And it's hard. It's hard to know if somebody's actually enriching the plutonium.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you got to go in and invade and fucking find out, which is not always, I don't know, taken well.
It's not always taken well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would second that. Yeah. So, I mean, this point I feel like should be underlined that these technologies, you know, carry with them extraordinary benefits, but the exact same artifact can be misused and abused to inflict some sort of harm on other humans. And not only that, a lot of the technologies like biotechnology, synthetic biology, nanotechnology, and even AI are, as you mentioned, they're becoming more and more powerful at something like an exponential rate, according to, you know, a universal Moore's law.
Yeah.
And not only that, but to make matters even worse, some of them are becoming increasingly accessible as well. So this isn't so much the case with nuclear weapons. In fact, they're not becoming more powerful either. There isn't ongoing research, although they are the U.S. and Russia are modernizing their nuclear weapons arsenals.
Hmm.
But things like biotechnology and synthetic biology and nanotechnology as well, although that's still a bit on the horizon of technological feasibility. These are becoming much more accessible to individuals. So you don't need, for example, a state, which is what you need to build a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, that's
Nor
true.
Do you need very rare materials. You can dig up anthrax in your backyard. You don't have to deal with, plutonium and uranium are extremely rare materials, and they're also extremely dangerous to handle.
And expensive, very expensive.
And very expensive. Yeah, exactly right. Mm-hmm. So once you have, you know, a sample of Ebola, you know, you have many samples. You know, it's easy to sort of to propagate these materials in the laboratory. There's a movement called biohacking.
Yeah,
which perhaps you've heard of, and yeah, they're working to basically automate certain processes, which just 10 years ago would have been incredibly difficult to perform, as well as make, you know, PCR machines and all sorts of other, you know, the paraphernalia of the laboratory extremely affordable.
They're doing it with CRISPR and Cas9. Like, this is something that now research labs that never could have afforded to do these things can do pretty cheaply and easily is basic genetic engineering, because the tools are so robust. And it's getting to the point where if you read about it enough and you care enough to do it, you can build your own garage lab. You don't need that much expensive equipment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So on the one hand, that's really exciting because... Mm-hmm. You know, there is a history of, you know, amateur astronomers who have made extraordinary, you know, startling discoveries. But on the other hand, you know, these same apparatuses could be used by, you know, a malicious individual, a terrorist organization, something of that sort to create, you know, there was a Global Challenges Foundation report out from last year. There was another one, the 2016 report out from a couple of months ago. But the one from last year mentioned that, you know, it's entirely conceivable that somebody now could synthesize a pathogen that combines the lethality of rabies, the incurability of Ebola, the contagiousness of the common cold, and the incubation period of HIV. And if you put all these together, I mean, you could have a bug that spreads, you know, at the speed of a jet liner across the ocean, across the world, through the London Underground, you know, into you know, a Manila slum.
And people wouldn't know it until they were dying.
And people wouldn't know it until years later, and then suddenly there's this, you know, incurable, lethal. I mean, it's really not it's not outside the realm of plausibility at this point.
Yeah, like so scary thing is, like, it makes no sense because you think in a rational way, like, why the fuck would anybody want to do that? But that's where we have to get back to these weird religious motivations and these crazy kind of esoteric motivations that don't seem to fit with what your concept of morality is, or don't seem to fit with what your concept of sanity is. And if we don't understand those motivations, we cannot link these technologies to them.
Yeah. So that's really what the book is about. It's looking at, you know, there are, you know, history is just littered with groups that believe, that genuinely believe that the world must be destroyed in order to be saved. And few people know about this, but, you know, it's extraordinary. It's startling. The Taping Rebellion, for example, that was an apocalyptic movement. The Taping Heavenly Kingdom that happened in the late 1800s, I believe. And that resulted in 30 million deaths or so, or perhaps 35 million deaths. You know, the establishment of Israel was in part explicitly motivated by eschatological considerations. So you know, there are lots of people who have extreme views that believe, you know, what matters is not this life, but the afterlife. It's not about achieving some goals in this world. It's about, you know, achieving certain rewards in the other world, you know, in the afterlife.
For sure. I mean, that's, so, most religions, I think, are littered with that. I mean, I grew up Mormon. Mormon definitely has that, as you have defined it, eschatological bent. I mean, LDS, especially men, believe that they will be given their own planet in the afterlife.
Yeah.
It'll shine in the celestial kingdom in the light of God, as close to God as they can possibly get. I mean, it's fully mapped. There's, like, levels of heaven, and there's rules about where you can go and where you can't go. Like, people spend a lot of fucking time thinking about what's going to happen after they die.
Yeah, so that's exactly true. So ultimately, the point is this: you know, there's a sense in which the secular movement is much more important today and in the future than it's ever been in the past, because not only are all of these traditions continuing into the future, but again, if you look at, like, the pew poll projections, religious belief will grow in the future. These end times beliefs are going to stick with us. And not only that, we're adding into the mix these immensely, unprecedentedly powerful emerging technologies, biotechnology, nanotechnology, and even AI systems that could be used by smaller and smaller groups to inflict greater and greater harm on human civilization. So there's sort of a lot of ingredients here that could together create something that's extremely combustible. And that worries me. In other words, I feel like a lot of the people who work in the field of existential risk studies, they like to talk about these risk scenarios in very abstract terms.
Yeah.
Sometimes you'll get mentions of some, you know, apocalyptic cult or some deranged individual who simply, you know, who is suicidal, but also has this omnicidal sort of urge, you know, to kill as many people as possible and then kill oneself. But there isn't much detailed, careful scholarship about who these agents are.
And also, like, it's like we talk about them as if they exist periodically, like they're these random blips. But we've seen, I mean, our grandparents who lived through World War II saw kamikaze soldiers. We, in our lifetimes, see suicide bombers. It happens all the time.
Yeah.
It's not just like this one random crazy guy. It's like a calling for these individuals, and it's a way to actually ensure that in that afterlife, they actually have more honor brought to them.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. There is definitely a devaluing of the present moment and the suffering that takes place in favor of this notion that, you know, once one, you know, this life is over, or more generally, I mean, that's a personal eschatology point, but in terms of cosmic eschatology, once this world is over, there will be this new paradisaical, you know, utopia that God's chosen people will enter into. And at that point, everything will be all right. You know, the ultimate aims of God's grand plan for humanity will have been accomplished. And so there's, without a doubt, I mean, this is part of the reason I have also focused a lot on apocalyptic movements in my research, because those are the most dangerous. Because there is this mm-hmm. sense of, I mean, when those memes really burrow deep in your psyche, and you believe that the end is just right around the corner, this is the grand cosmic battle, you know, before the most climactic important moment in all of history. There's a kind of moral urgency to that moment that true believers can use to justify all sorts of barbaric and catastrophic acts. In the past, though, these individuals have been, their ability to, you know, to disturb and to injure society have really been limited by the means available. And
yeah,
in the future...
That's true. Like, yeah. A shitty car bomb is a shitty car bomb.
Yeah, yes.
Like, you can only do so much damage with that. But if you can unlock the ability to... I mean, fuck. Does anybody watch Orphan Black? This is what this show is about. Like, I don't know if you've seen it. I'm kind of obsessed with it. It's about clones. But the deeper you get into the, you know, the stories behind these clones on this show, the more you understand the company behind it and their kind of goals of, I don't know, of producing a perfect human and taking away sort of biological choices that have existed throughout millennia. And mm-hmm. and there is this nefarious goal to, you know, it's very much like early Nazism, you know, this goal to purify humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I mean, the notion of purification is found in a lot of religions, a lot of eschatological systems.
Yeah, it's like cleansing by fire.
Yeah, there's a movement in the U.S. called the Christian Identity Movement, and this is a sort of a broad ideology that has informed the particular views of like the KKK and the Aryan Nations and the Order and many other Christian terrorist organizations, and they believe that it's based on this notion that the British are the true Israelis. Mm. It's a very weird set of ideas.
But it does have this like eugenic core that seems to
absolutely
really be related to this apocalyptic thinking.
Yeah. So the notion of purification is central to their particular worldview.
Yeah.
And furthermore, I mean, they explicitly see the use of, you know, advanced technologies, extraordinarily destructive technologies, including nuclear weaponry, as potential, you know, a way to purify the world through fire of sort. So yeah, I mean, in fact, the Christian Identity Movement, individuals affiliated with Christian Identity Movement, have been among the most. They've been individuals who the FBI and CIA and other organizations like that have had their eyes on for a long time,
mm-hmm.
because they pose a very serious domestic threat. But there's so many other examples. Aum Shinrikyo in Japan had this very same view, and you know, they're from the 1990s, and they were the ones responsible for perpetrating the worst terrorist attack in Japan. And they were explicitly apocalyptic in their outlook. So I guess part of the idea is, you know, imagine Aum Shinrikyo. I don't think that groups like that are going to disappear in the future. In fact, I just published an article in Skeptic Magazine arguing that there are multiple empirical reasons for thinking that groups of this sort will non-trivially increase in size and frequency in the future. Mm-hmm. And then add, again, you know, imagine these groups with nanotechnology or with synthetic biology at the tips of their fingers. I mean, it's an exercise in nightmares to imagine what the future might look like.
Oh, okay. So I'm officially depressed. I'm excited to read your book because I'm hoping, all good authors do this. I don't know about all good philosophers, but I am hoping that after teaching us about these eschatological viewpoints and after helping the reader really understand these motivations, there is some sort of call to action or some sort of path to reform.
Yeah.
Something that we can hold on to, that we can look forward to. Like, how do we prevent this from happening? What can we do?
Yeah. So the last chapter does have a large section, which is entirely dedicated to understanding various strategies for mitigating the risks that are sort of haunting the 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
My approach actually for this section was to not to look at sort of very specific policy proposals, which some individuals have done,
mm-hmm,
with quite a bit of insight, but it was really sort of bigger picture strategies for ensuring a safe passage through what appears to be a bottleneck of heightened hazards for our species. So there are things like space colonization.
Okay.
Is one of the strategies that's been, Elon Musk has been talking about this a lot recently, and has in fact explicitly described space colonization as ultimately a humanitarian effort, because sort of the further out in space we are, the less likely it is that a single catastrophe is going to eliminate our lineage. So for example, if we had colonies, thriving colonies on Mars, you could have a gray goose scenario on Earth, whereby self-replicating nanobots are released into the biosphere and sort of gobble up, all forms of life, and resulting in the Earth being this sort of lifeless, dusty sphere.
Yeah.
And nonetheless, we'd still have some progeny out there on Mars to continue. So that's one of them. I think the other biggest one has to do with artificial intelligence and the creation of a friendly artificial intelligence who's able and willing to help us solve some of these big problems and sort of get through this sort of weird squeeze where we have these ancient ideologies that are mixing with these very advanced neoteric technologies. Which again is those are the ingredients that are potentially combustible or volatile or whatever.
That's your number two, is to create superintelligence. We did skip number one, redesign the human form.
Yeah,
so it's pretty exciting. But I've seen this a lot with, these new biohacking kind of movements and these conversations about climate change and about some of these more existential risks. Like, what mm-hmm. can we do to help mitigate those problems? How can we sort of, speed up evolution, as it were, by improving our own genetic predispositions?
Yeah. There is. So I should also say this. And part of the reason I wrote a book on the darker side of advanced technology, the darker side of humanity, is that the brighter side is profoundly hopeful. I mean, there's so many extraordinary possibilities.
And we don't even have to think about the future. Like, we can literally just look at today versus 20 years ago, today versus 40 years ago, and look at infant mortality and look at how many people are dying of waterborne diseases and how many, it's like it's insane. It's almost hard to comprehend what kinds of improvements we've made.
Absolutely. So another way to put it is, if any listeners have ever read Steven Pinker's Better Angels of Our Nature,
mm-hmm.
or Michael Shermer has what Pinker actually has described as a sequel to his book called The Moral Arc.
Yeah.
I mean, they plot out all of this empirical data that very cogently supports the claim that the world is getting better in multiple domains, from animal rights to women's rights to minorities.
To human intelligence.
To intelligence. There's the Flynn effect, you know, which perhaps ties into that. There's, you know, human health, human life, you know, life expectancy, and so on and so on. I mean, there is an abundance of reason for hope. And the problem is that there's this parallel trend according to which the world is, while it's becoming better in many, many very real, important senses, it's also becoming more dangerous. You know, again, smaller and smaller groups are able to wreak more and more havoc on civilization. So I want to focus on that stuff because I want all of the wonderful, you know, possibilities to be realized. And I think the only way to do that is to focus, you know, the first step in terms of battling the various risks that confront us is to understand what they are, to understand their nature, in this conversation, we haven't even talked about climate change and biodiversity loss, which I think they're low on the list of existential risks, but they're very high up on the risks, on the list of catastrophic risks. So these are, you know, oftentimes they're described as like threat multipliers or conflict multipliers, because they're going to push, you know, civilizations to the brink of collapse. And in doing so, they're going to pull down the conflict threshold that sort of keeps state and non-state actors at peace.
Yeah.
So they'll make it more likely for there to be wars, perhaps wars involving advanced weaponry or weapons of mass destruction or weapons of total destruction. So I think it's absolutely crucial. I mean, I would say that my own assessment of the likelihood of us making it through the next couple centuries will depend in large part on what happens in the next decade. You know, if Donald Trump is voted into the Oval Office, you know, and he abolishes what he calls the Department of the Environment, which he means the EPA.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so he would abolish that. There was just some articles out recently, one published in Nature, and it was co-authored by, over 20 scientists from around the world. We're saying that really the policies implemented, there's a tiny window, a decadal window here where we can implement policies to mitigate the consequences of climate change or else face at least 10,000 years of significant changes to the global climate. Basically more time in the future than civilization has in the past so far existed. That's what we're determining right now. So the stakes are extraordinarily high. And I think if climate change is not dealt with, and if we back out of the Paris Agreement and so on and so on, then that would greatly elevate the probability of a catastrophe involving advanced nanoweaponry or involving some sort of weaponized AI. So there's really all, you know, there are many layers of risks that are interrelated in various ways and perhaps in some cases have a synergistic kind of effect on each other. And it's crucial, the first step is to understand what these risks are. And then beyond that, I would say there are things like space colonization or redesigning the human form through cognitive enhancement.
Or more simple things that individuals can do, like limit your water or limit your water usage, and like literally smaller things that we can do to make a really big impact.
Yes. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that.
But it does make me wonder. Yep. Okay, I have to ask, for people who are listening right now and are like, ah, like having like anxiety problems from this conversation, there are a lot of people, and I struggle with this myself, it's hard for me to live in a paranoid way. And it's hard for me to I'm not good about locking my doors. Like my boyfriend's always like, lock the fucking door when you leave the house, Kara. Like, what are you doing? Or when you're home, you should keep it locked. And I'm like, why? I'm home. Like, and it's just a difference in the way that I view things. And I don't want to be crippled with this kind of existential fear. How can I be responsibly concerned without just putting my head in the sand and going, I'm just going to straight up ignore it because otherwise I'll be too stressed all the time?
Yeah, I think it's very important to, one thing I've emphasized in some of my writing is that, you know, you don't, there are two extremes that that you could sink into when talking or ruminating these issues. One is panic.
Yeah.
You know, and some people do get panicked about like climate change. I'm trying to remember, there was a very interesting Anthropocebo effect.
Anthropocebo? I love it. What does it mean? Is it like Anthropocene plus placebo?
No. So it was coined by a woman who, a professor, I think at NYU, if I remember correctly. This is sort of dusty memory, but you, listeners can look it up, and I'm sure you'll find it. She wrote about it on theedge.org. Mm-hmm. And it basically refers to, it's on the model of placebo, yeah, or nocebo. And it's basically this idea that, you know, you read a little bit about climate change and you start to despair. And as a result of that, you don't do anything. You don't take action. You just feel overwhelmed with a kind of despondency about the future of the biosphere and the future of the climate.
Yeah.
So I think that is one danger, this sort of panic and and the other is just nihilism. Where
yeah,
you
which
just,
is easy to kind of slip into.
Yeah. And that ties into also to the effect that I just mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's just this sense that, this fatalistic sense that it's going to turn out poorly and there's nothing you can do about it. So I think it's really, really important to avoid those extremes.
Yeah.
And to try to think clearly about these issues, because there's not a single risk that's facing us. Not a single known existential risk, with perhaps the exception of AI. But all of the other ones are absolutely soluble. Like, mm-hmm, we know what to do about climate change. We know what to do about biodiversity loss, which I've argued in articles that it's just as severe as climate change, although it's almost never talked about.
Yeah, I mean, and they're fully linked.
And absolutely. And I would say not only are they fully linked, they're reciprocally linked.
Yeah.
You know, one climate change is one of several causal factors behind biodiversity loss. And biodiversity loss could exacerbate climate change.
And absolutely is, especially in the oceans.
Yeah. Yeah. So, So I think, you know, we know how to solve these problems. We know how to solve, bioterrorism, and so on and so on. I mean, all of the other risks that have talked about, there are things that we can do. It's just a matter of humanity getting in its right mind, forgetting about all of the extraordinarily improbable end time scenarios that humanity has been obsessed with, mm-hmm, for the past several millennia, and adopt a scientific frame of mind, look at our present predicament, and recognize that, you know, the human condition, human situation here on Earth really is precarious. I mean, even if you just look at the history of our genus, Homo, there was, you know, that branch of the evolutionary tree was quite bushy at one point. And there are, you know, many, many other forms of humanity, Homo habilis, Homo floresiensis, Neanderthals were a form of humanity. All of them have died out.
Yeah.
We're the only one remaining. So it's, you know, that should give us a sense of fragility on the Earth. And, you know, and then when we look at what we're doing to the planet and these new technologies and so on, we should be concerned and, you know, try to take some rational steps towards making the world a better place.
Hear, hear. You know, this really makes me want to, I don't often do this in my podcast where I like sample in other sounds, but I've been so reminded throughout this conversation of an incredible speech that was delivered in a wonderful film called The Great Dictator, a Charlie Chaplin film. I don't know if people listening have seen it. It was in 1940. And there's an incredible speech that his character in the film, the Jewish barber, delivers at the very end. And I'm going to play it for you guys right now so that you can hear it, because I think that it sums up what we've been talking about quite wonderfully.
I'm sorry, but I don't want to be an emperor. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I should like to help everyone if possible. Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like that. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery. We don't want to hate and despise one another. In this world, there's room for everyone, and the good earth is rich and can provide for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful, but we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls, has barricaded the world with hate, has goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed, but we have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical, our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much and feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent, and all will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness in men, cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world, millions of despairing men, women, and children, victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Yeah, so I love that speech. I think it really embodies, in a little bit more of a simplistic way, but this idea that there are these incredible machines and these incredible technological advancements that men and women made with their own two hands that have the power to heal and have the power to destroy. And it's about morality, and it's about unity, and it's about humanity that we actually use them the way that they will propagate and improve our future and not destroy it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, the Great Dictator was such an extraordinary film. And for listeners out there who haven't seen it, it's very much worth watching. And it was filmed in or released in 1940. I mean, this was after World War II had commenced. But yeah, the climactic talk at the end is very poignant, very deep, and yeah, it definitely foreshadows I think a lot of the issues. I mean, actually, you know, he's talking before the atomic age.
Yeah, it's so fascinating when you hear these kinds of conversations. I mean, this is the type of sci-fi, for example, that I love is Bradbury and Vonnegut and Orwell and those things that are so prescient, like even, you know, a century later, they still speak to us because the truth of the matter is the themes are always there. Just like you were saying, these early themes of end times have been around for millennia. It's just the tools that we now have to be able to either mitigate or speed up some of these these end times. So I've got to say, first of all, that I thank you so much for coming on the show because I've learned a lot. And second of all, I would be remiss if I didn't close the show without asking you the same two questions I ask everybody on the podcast. I feel like I probably know the answer to them, but I would love to get your succinct answer. It's funny. Sometimes the two questions fully relate to the conversation we've been having, and other times they're totally different. And so they are in this order, so as to end on a high note. The first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that you're most concerned about? What is that thing that keeps you up most at night? But then on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic about and really like looking forward to?
Well, I think the answer to the first question depends on the timescale we're talking about. So there are a lot of sort of near-term worries that relate to the more immediate effects of climate change or potentially a nuclear exchange. You know, Bin Laden called it his religious duty to acquire weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. The Islamic State has explicitly fantasized about acquiring a nuclear weapon. So this is an ongoing concern that is, you know, could potentially impact us within, you know, the foreseeable future. In fact, if you read a lot of the experts on nuclear terrorism, they give it roughly a 50% chance of a nuclear weapon being detonated in a major urban center in the U.S. within a 10-year period.
Oh, geez.
So, yeah, so it's those are, I think that's my main sort of short-term concern. Medium term probably would have to do with bioterrorism, the use of CRISPR, for example, to modify to weaponize Ebola or weaponize Spanish flu, which killed, you know, 63 million more people in 2 years than World War I did in 4 years.
Yeah.
So, and then I think in the long term right now, it's superintelligence, I think, would be the biggest long-term concern. Although I would hasten to add that it would be foolish for humanity to think that we know all of the different types of risks facing us today. So it could very well be, I mean, CRISPR sort of came out of nowhere.
That's true. Yeah, a lot of people foresee it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was an extraordinary breakthrough. Now they're, you know, the same technology is being used to modify RNA, not just DNA. So, you know, the rapidity of technology is such that, you know, there could be all sorts of novel and extraordinarily beneficial, but also extraordinarily dangerous technologies that are just hidden behind the horizon of our technological imaginations right now. So I also worry about what we might discover, you know, 20 years or maybe 10 years down the road that could be world changing in some sort of way.
Sort of the unknown.
The unknown, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I have a whole section in the book on unknowns and how they're which I sort of playfully call monsters. And I consider these monsters to be perhaps the most significant risk to our collective future. But I mean, that being said, you know, as I'd mentioned before, I mean, along with the peril is a huge amount of promise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I genuinely don't think it's crazy to fantasize about a kind of techno-utopian world in which we've expanded our consciousness through brain-machine interfaces or by uploading our minds to a computer at which point we would be more or less immortal, you know, all the way to until the heat death of the universe. And, you know, life extension technologies, you know, CRISPR, you know, offers all sorts of possibilities for curing cancer and curing Alzheimer's and so on and so on. So I really, you know, there was a time when I first got into to this topic and was reading a lot about transhumanism,
mm-hmm.
and felt like there was a, I think Sam Harris has this exact same view, although I don't want to misquote him, but I think he has talked about how he initially found it to be almost a kind of quasi-religious.
Yeah, and I do too, I have to admit. Like, I've had some issues with these kind of singularity
yeah.
activists and these Kurzweilian followers that it almost doesn't seem to be in step with science. Like, it's yeah. a hope and a goal in the future, but there's some people who kind of think it's happening now.
Yeah, so maybe I would distinguish between what might be called like naive transhumanists or naive singularitarianism,
mm-hmm.
singularitarianists, and those who have a more balanced view
sure.
about the, you know, the risks that are involved with this whole technological enterprise that we're all to some extent involuntarily embarked on.
Yeah.
But so that being said, I mean, I do think there are elements of. There are versions of transhumanism that very much are religious, and it's, you know, a lot of their predictions or expectations are kind of faith-based in a sense. But I think there's another perspective whereby you can anticipate genuinely glorious, you know, phenomena in the future that is really more evidentially robust than the other versions.
Yeah.
So I would say, I mean, I absolutely look forward to, if we can only manage to get through, you grow up as a species and not be so obsessed with the tribalism of religion and nationalism and so on, then I think, you know, our species could enter into this new era of, you know, extraordinary marvels. So,
here's hoping.
Yeah.
Well, Phil, thank you so much. Hey, I want to make sure that everyone has the opportunity who's interested in checking out your book and who's interested in finding you on social media in doing so. So why don't you let people know where they can find all that good stuff?
Sure. So you can follow me on Twitter at xriskology. So X and then risk, O-L-O-G-Y.
Love it.
And my website is www.risksandreligion.org. And that's a fledgling institute that I started a year ago called the X-Risks Institute.
Very cool. And they can learn more about the end, what science and religion tell us about the apocalypse, by visiting your website?
Yes, that's correct. And it's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. Yeah, it's pretty, I mean, if you Google it, you'll come up with lots of results.
All the places.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Phil, thank you so much for joining me. I learned a lot. I had a wonderful time. And everybody listening, thank you for tuning in week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.